child begins to believe it.
That's James Baldwin speaking in June of 1963, that audio from the Pacifica Radio Archives. In this last minute we have with you, Ta-Nehisi Coates, where have we come in more than half a century?
I think there's been some progress. I think if people like me appear impatient, it is with the fact that, you know, we are talking about a system that has basically been in place since 1619. Progress is good, but until, you know, we live in a country in which white supremacy has been banished, until we live in a country where one can look at, you know, prisons if we ought to have them and not see an 8-to-1 ratio, until we can, you know, look at a country and not, you know, see black men comprising roughly 8% of the world's, you know, imprisoned population, until, you know, we can, you know, have a situation in which, you know, I can turn on the news or come on this show and be able to discuss other things besides, you know, Sandra Bland being threatened with being, you know, to light her up, as he said, over a turn signal, until we have a situation in which Tamir Rice, you know, who's out playing, you know, is not, you know, effectively committing a lethal crime, you know, a crime that threatens his life. You know, until we have a situation where, you know, Kajimi Powell, from mere fact of being mentally ill, is not shot down in the street, until we have, you know, a situation in which, you know, John Crawford, you know, who is shopping in Walmart, is not shot down and executed in a store. Progress is nice, but it's, you know, to be noted, and the struggle continues after that.
Ta-Nehisi Coates, author of Between the World and Me. To see our whole interview, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. That does it for our show. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Carla Wills, Laura Gottesdiener, Dina Guzder, Amy Littlefield, Nermeen Sheikh, Sam Alkoff, Robbie Karen, Steve Martinez, Hani Massoud, Juan Carlos Davila, and Pedro Rodriguez. Mike DiFilippo and Miguel Noguera are our engineers. Special thanks to Becca Staley, Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Our website's democracynow.org.
You are listening to KBOO Portland, where the time is now 8:01. Coming up next is more talk radio with guest host John Walsh of the Labor Show Collective, presenting a special Labor Day edition of More Talk Radio. Today's focus is solidarity.
Have you entered the KBOO Fall Membership Drive sweepstakes? The grand prize is a trip to Busurias, Mexico, including $1,000 in airfare and a week's worth of lodging at Casa Tranquila. Other prizes include a Portland Center Stage Flex Pass, hundreds of dollars to Grand Central Bakery, and health and wellness packages at Evolution Healthcare and Fitness. We have raised over $10,000 at this time to help shorten the fall membership drive. Remember, for every $15,000 we raise before September 9th, we will take one day off our fall membership drive. A donation is not required to enter the sweepstakes. For more info, visit kboo.fm/2015fallsweeps. And thank you to everyone who has donated early to the fall membership drive.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to present Arresting Power, Resisting Police Violence in Portland, Oregon, as part of the KBOO at the Clinton Monthly Film Series. Arresting Power documents the history of conflict between the Portland police and community members throughout the past 50 years and creates a space for understanding the impacts of police violence and imagining a world without police. Again, that's Arresting Power, Thursday, September 10th, 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Oregon Black History Heroes and Legends, a three-day event from September 11th through 13th. The keynote speaker for this 20th anniversary celebration will be Mr. Les Pee Wee Harrison. And other speakers include Imani Muhammad, Mike Crenshaw, Jamo Greenidge, and more. That's Oregon Black History Heroes and Legends, September 11th through 13th, at venues across Portland. Location, speakers, and more information can be found at kbu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. Welcome to our Labor Day Solidarity Special. My name is John Walsh. We got Steve on the controls in the engineer room, and we're going to talk about struggles and movements internationally, nationwide, and right here around Portland, because all those things are interrelated. We can all learn from each other and be in solidarity with each other in those struggles and movements. The first part of the show, we're going to talk about workers in Colombia affected by the free trade regime. These are injured workers who worked for U.S.-based multinationals and have been hurt on the job and kicked to the curb. We'll have an interview recorded in Bogota a week ago yesterday, and we'll hear from them real soon here. After that, we're going to talk live with Al Bradbury, who writes for Labor Notes in New York City and used to be part of the Labor Radio Collective right here in Portland. So we'll get a nationwide perspective on what's happening in the movement in the U.S. with Al. And then we'll talk with Diana Pei-Wu, who's the new executive director of Portland Jobs with Justice, about what's going on here and now right near home. So let's start off by going to the recorded interview, which is done in Spanish, but here has English translation too, with injured workers in Colombia.
We're talking with injured workers here in Colombia. First, if you could introduce yourselves.
Mi nombre es Carlos Ernesto Trujillo Rojas. Es trabajador de General Motors con motores.
My name is Carlos Ernesto Trujillo Rojas, ex-worker of General Motors con motores.
Octavio Pérez Otálora, trabajador de Hidroeléctrica El Quimbo.
Octavio Pérez, ex-worker of Hydroelectric Quimbo. And what happened in the workplace that resulted in you being injured now?
Yo duré trabajando 6 años en General Motors en Colombia. Debido a los altos ritmos de producción, los compañeros empezaron a presentar enfermedades de origen profesional y se empezaron a retirar pues poco a poco, ya que a medida que la empresa se iba dando cuenta quién era el trabajador enfermo, pues la empresa los iba despidiendo uno a uno.
I worked for 6 years for General Motors in Colombia, and because of the high speed of production, the people in the workplace began to display occupational health symptoms. And as the company found out that workers were not healthy, they began to get rid of them one by one.
En el caso mío, yo tuve una enfermedad de los hombros, donde pues puse en conocimiento a la empresa y la empresa pues me despidió tan pronto se dio cuenta de mi enfermedad.
In my case, I developed a shoulder problem and the company got rid of me as soon as they learned of this problem.
De esta manera pues la empresa no reconoció el origen de la enfermedad mía, no quiso reconocerla y me despidió, echándome a la calle como a cientos de compañeros dentro de Colmotores que entregaron su vida a esta empresa.
So the company in this way was able to avoid responsibility, throwing me out in the street the same way they did hundreds of others who had given their lives to the company. How is it possible for the company to know the injured workers were injured?
La empresa se daba cuenta que los trabajadores estaban enfermos porque dentro de la empresa cada año hacían chequeos médicos y además dentro de la empresa había un departamento médico el cual se encargaba de pasarle esta información a la empresa.
The company knew because every year there were checkups inside the company, inside the plant, and the medical department would pass this information on to the company.
Tan pronto hacían los chequeos médicos anuales, el médico de la empresa o de la EPS, quien estaba trabajando dentro de la misma empresa, él le informaba al gerente de la empresa y le decía, mire, tantos trabajadores, este es el nombre, el apellido del trabajador que está enfermo, para que usted mire a ver qué va a hacer con este trabajador.
As soon as the checkups were done, the doctor of the health provider, which was actually located inside the company, inside the plant, would tell the bosses, look, these guys are the ones who are sick, what do you want to do about them? And that was how they knew to get rid of us. And what happened in your case?
Tuve un accidente y apenas se enteraron, de una vez me sacaron. Salí con enfermedad de dos hernias, umbilical, inguinal y de la columna, un golpe aquí en la cabeza. Y apenas enteraron, me sacaron. Y no me han ayudado para nada.
Well, I had an accident. I had two hernias, a spinal injury. I was hit in the head. And as soon as they learned about that, they got rid of me and gave me no help at all. And how did the accident happen?
Y me caí cargando una bomba.
I fell. I was carrying a pump and I fell. And under Colombian law, what is the company's responsibility?
Por ley colombiana, la responsabilidad de la empresa es proteger al trabajador enfermo y discapacitado. Está precisamente incluso dentro del Código Sustantivo del Trabajo y dentro de la ley constitucional.
Mm-hmm. Under Colombian law, the company is obligated to protect the injured worker, both under the administrative code, the labor code, and also by constitutional law.
Pues la empresa lo que tiene que hacer es simplemente llevar un debido proceso, averiguar verdaderamente si la enfermedad es de origen profesional y de esta manera la empresa tiene que responder por la enfermedad del trabajador.
The company is supposed to follow due process to see if the condition is occupational, and if so, do what it's supposed to take care of the worker. How?
Tenemos muchas maneras. Tenemos, por ejemplo, la reubicación dentro de la planta. Y cuando el caso es extremo de que el trabajador esté muy enfermo, la empresa simplemente pues lo pensiona.
There are several possibilities. One is to relocate the worker within the plant. And if it's a really serious condition, if the person is very much sick or injured, then the company can pension that person.
En otros casos, hay algo que se llama el artículo 140, en el cual la empresa le permiten a que tenga al trabajador en la casa descansando y le pagan igualmente. Uh-huh. Pero esto no representa ninguna garantía para el trabajador, pues cuando el trabajador está incapacitado en su casa descansando, le llega su carta de despido a la casa.
There's another possibility under a different article, Article 140. The company can have the worker stay home and continue to pay the worker. But the worker has no guarantees in that case because while the worker is home resting, the letter can arrive saying that the worker has been discharged. And did any of those things happen in your cases? Were you relocated or pensioned or paid to stay home?
En el caso de nosotros, ninguno.
Ninguno.
Nosotros fuimos despedidos.
No, none of that. We were simply discharged.
Nada.
Nada, no, señor. Por eso nos obligamos a venirnos para acá porque los señores de General Motors nos dieron asilo para poder estar aquí, para estar más cerquita porque nosotros somos muy pobres. Ellos nos dieron asilo acá para poder estar más cerca del ministerio, a ver si de pronto nos ayuda.
Nothing happened. That's why we were obligated to come here. That's why we had to come from farther away in Colombia to here, where the workers from General Motors gave us a place to stay, where they supported us because we had no resources. We had no way to make anything, make progress. It's worth mentioning that right now we're in Bogota, the capital of Colombia, and moreover, we're in what's known as the Tents of Resistance, right in front of the U.S. Embassy. And Carlos, how did the tents come to be here?
Todo empezó fue porque los trabajadores ponían sus denuncias ante la justicia colombiana. Y la justicia colombiana nunca tuvo garantías para los trabajadores. Por el contrario, la razón siempre se la daban a las empresas.
It started after the workers had made condemnations in front of the Colombian judicial system, and the judicial system failed to provide any guarantees for the workers. To the contrary, the courts sided with the company.
Entonces, ¿qué vimos nosotros? Nos dimos cuenta que el Ministerio de Trabajo estaba completamente amangualado con la empresa Colmotores, en el caso de Colmotores, y nosotros decidimos organizarnos en asociación.
We saw that the Ministry of Labor was completely intertied with the company, in our case with Colmotores, General Motors, and we decided to form an association.
Y cuando creamos la asociación, nos unimos pues un pequeño grupo para empezar e iniciar protestas en frente de la empresa para que de esta manera presionara a la empresa para que solucionara el problema de los trabajadores discapacitados.
We formed our association, ASOTRECOL, the Association of injured workers and ex-workers of General Motors Colombia, and we began to protest in front of the plant to pressure the company to resolve our case.
Entonces nosotros lo que buscamos es un diálogo político, y es un arreglo con la empresa. Simplemente hemos buscado es un diálogo, ya que la justicia no brinda ninguna clase de garantía para ningún trabajador ni para ninguna persona en este país.
We were seeking a dialogue, a political dialogue with the company, because the judicial system was not providing any guarantees for the workers or indeed for anyone in this country.
Nosotros vimos que ninguna de las respuestas por parte de las entidades del gobierno eran favorables para nosotros. Por el contrario, siempre tenían la razón la empresa, y ellos simplemente pues apoyaban a la empresa, pues porque esta empresa le brindaba trabajo a cientos de miles de trabajadores. Y esa era la excusa de ellos. Pero la verdad, en el tema pues laboral, General Motors con motores pues estaba violando completamente los derechos laborales.
The authorities wouldn't do anything with us when we made our condemnations. They would take the view that because the company employs hundreds of workers that they couldn't do anything about it, although Comotores was massively violating labor rights.
Pues decidimos organizarnos y venirnos para acá, para el frente de la embajada norteamericana, ya que en ese momento General Motors pertenecía al gobierno norteamericano, y además estábamos a punto de firmar un tratado de libre comercio con Estados Unidos, donde en los primeros puntos se hablaba sobre el respeto y la dignidad de los derechos laborales.
So we decided to take up our position in front of the U.S. Embassy because at that moment General Motors belonged to the United States government, and because at that moment the free trade agreement with the United States was about to be signed. And one of the first points was to call for the respect of labor rights.
Entonces nosotros dijimos, hombre, tenemos que hacer respetar ese derecho, ese punto, respeto y dignidad por los derechos laborales, y que igualmente siga el Tratado de Libre Comercio.
And we figured, hey, well, if that's the case, respect our labor rights. This is an example of what needs to be taken into account.
Pero el Tratado de Libre Comercio lo único es que ha hecho es afectar la industria colombiana, hacer de que los trabajadores sean despedidos masivamente, y también obligando al desplazamiento forzado por parte de multinacionales, ¿sí?, contra los campesinos e indígenas de nuestros países, de nuestras ciudades.
But all the free trade agreement has done is affect Colombian industry, causing massive layoffs of workers, resulting in forced displacement. Forced displacement of people from the countryside, of indigenous communities, from the countryside to the cities.
Y pues esto nos obligó definitivamente a venirnos aquí enfrente de la embajada, pues a oponernos primero que todo contra la masacre laboral que estaba ocasionando Colmotores, y poner en conocimiento a los dos gobiernos sobre el tema del Tratado de Libre Comercio para que se respetara lo que se había pactado antes de que se firmara el Tratado de Libre Comercio en el año 2011.
So we took up our location in front of the embassy in the first place to protest the massacre of our labor rights at General Motors, but also to make both governments aware of the situation with labor rights so that they would respect what they had signed before the free trade agreement was finalized in 2011.
Y lo que ha pasado con el tema de los tratados de libre comercio, lo que estamos viendo ahora, despidos masivos de trabajadores discapacitados, despidos injustificados, tercerización laboral, ¿sí?, acoso laboral.
And we're seeing now what free trade agreements mean: massive layoffs of injured workers, unjustified layoffs of workers, contingent employment, harassment of workers.
2 de agosto del año 2011 tomamos la decisión de venirnos para acá.
So we came here on August 2nd of 2011.
Y como te das cuenta, John, pues ya hoy cumplimos 1492 días, ¿ves?
Más que 4 años en las carpas.
Más que 4 años.
And now we've been here 1492 days, more than 4 years.
Seguimos siendo opositores número uno del Tratado de Libre Comercio. Pensamos que el Plan de Acción Laboral nos está respetando.
We continue to be opponents number one of the Free Trade Agreement. We believe the Labor Action Plan has not been respected.
Seguimos siendo opositores, y igual de todas maneras sabemos que gracias a la lucha, las condiciones dentro de la empresa para los compañeros de Colmotores acá en Colombia, para más de 2,000 empleados, las condiciones mejoraron completamente.
We continue to be opponents, and we know that thanks to the struggle, the conditions for workers inside the plant of General Motors Colmotores in Colombia, for more than 1,000 workers, have improved dramatically.
Te puedes dar cuenta que los trabajadores enfermos ahora ya son reubicados, ¿sí? Ya no volvieron a despedir trabajadores discapacitados.
Now injured workers are being relocated. They're not being fired anymore.
Invirtieron 18 millones de dólares en mejoras ergonómicas para mejorar el trabajo de los trabajadores y de esta manera bajar el índice de incidentabilidad que había dentro de la compañía.
The company invested millions in improvements, ergonomic improvements, to lower the accident rate, so things are better inside the plant now.
Nosotros tenemos claro que tenemos que seguir la lucha. La ideología de nosotros es clara, es un reintegro, es cuestión de dignidad.
We're clear about the fact that we have to continue in the struggle. The purpose is obvious, it's reinstatement, it's a question of dignity.
Apoyen esta causa que es pequeñita pero muy grande para los trabajadores, para cambiar el rumbo laboral en Colombia.
And may people support this cause, which is very small, but at the same time very big for changing the direction of labor rights in Colombia. Thank you, compañeros, and may you continue until victory.
No es solamente la victoria de los trabajadores en Colombia, sino los trabajadores a nivel mundial.
And that will be not only a victory for workers in Colombia, but a victory for workers internationally.
That was our interview with Colombian workers injured on the job and kicked to the curb, finding no rights, contrary to what was supposedly guaranteed under the free trade agreement between the U.S. and Colombia. An example of how free trade that hurts us here hurts workers elsewhere as well, and how we have a common cause in fighting proposed free trade agreements that make that even worse. If you understand Spanish, you can hear that entire interview by going to www.kboo.fm, where it's posted online. If you go to the promo for this show, you'll find the exact link. Changing gears now, we're going to talk rather than about international aspects of the labor movement, about national ones. And we have on the phone with us from New York, Al Bradbury, who writes for Labor Notes and also used to be a member of the Labor Radio Collective here in Portland. Welcome, Al.
Thanks. Happy Labor Day, John.
Likewise to you. And thanks for rejoining us, coming back to your roots, as it were.
My pleasure.
So can you give us a perspective from what you see from New York and working with Labor Notes about some of the major issues that cut across the labor movement in the U.S.? What are the big themes, not the nitty-gritty stuff necessarily, but what are the overarching themes that you see from your perch over there in the Big Apple?
Sure. Well, certainly I think any observer of labor would say that organized labor is under sustained attack, continues to be under sustained attack, with a particular focus now on public sector unions, since private sector unions have been so thoroughly decimated that the public sector is the bulwark of remaining labor strength in some sense, and teachers in particular are under a sort of an ideological and an economic attack, but are also organizing and taking action in an exciting way across the country. So we see strikes and near strikes and work to rule actions and sit-ins and protests going on by teachers and parents and students together with them in everywhere from New York State to Hawaii to all over Chicago, of course. So I'd love to talk more about that. And Seattle teachers are on the verge of striking. Half the teachers in Washington State went on rolling strikes this spring. But that's one theme, and I would say one area of real hope in the labor movement that I see.
What is it about teachers and education that makes that a different sort of situation for organizing and for mobilization? What are the characteristics that have turned that into one of the big positives as far as recent news in labor?
You know, one of the things I think that's especially clear in the case of teachers, though it's not unique to them, is the way that there's a broader community interest at stake in the fights of teachers. And it's been, I think, really fun and exciting to see over the last couple of years quite a rebellion by teachers against standardized testing, for instance, against spending so many hours of their time not teaching students but testing them. Again, teachers speaking as in a union voice more and more directly about the racial injustice in our school system, about racial inequality and the underfunding of the schools that serve Black and Latino students especially, and the driving of teachers of color out of the profession as well. And about underfunding schools in general and overcrowding of classrooms and how that affects whole communities. So I think that something that's especially clear in the case of teachers is both that they need to ally with their communities to win. There's sort of in a sector like that, you don't have the kind of leverage, the kind of straight economic leverage that you do if you're in, say, a profit-making factory, where if you can shut the factory down, the boss is going to be losing money by the minute. Public schools serve the public and serve especially working-class people. And so there's not a, profits aren't lost by the minute when you close them down. It's you have to be able to create a political crisis for the decision-makers to have leverage. So I think it's clear that teachers need the public to win, but also that that teachers and the public have a common interest, and you've seen all these fights that are taking on the public interest and what students need and what communities need, and teachers being willing to say the status quo isn't okay with us. I think sometimes labor gets boxed into the corner of defending the way things are against the threat that things become even worse, and it's inspiring to see teachers saying, we don't think our schools are okay the way they are. We think they need a lot more funding and a lot more staffing and a lot more respect for teachers to be able to do their work well, and respect for students and parents. And we need to tackle these racial inequities. I think there's a lesson that that a lot of other public sector workers and private sector workers could take from the approach that we're seeing teachers taking.
And this also fits with the approach of Labor Notes. Maybe you should tell folks a bit more about Labor Notes, putting the movement back in the labor movement.
Sure, yeah. Labor Notes is a 35, 36-year-old project now that came about when it was founded in 1979, really to bring together currents of rank-and-file democracy, reformers trying to change their unions from the bottom up. At the time, in the Teamsters and the auto workers and the mine workers, there were these currents. And Labor Notes was sort of first started as a newsletter to bring those reform movements together and help them feel part of a bigger movement. I think over the ensuing decades, the project has broadened. Some has kept that commitment to rank-and-file democracy and bottom-up unions that are really run by their members. We've also, I think, become a kind of gathering place and a node in the labor movement for people who want to build a more active, more militant, more bottom-up, certainly, labor movement, and a place for people to share skills and talk strategies and, teach each other how to organize our coworkers, how to do better more effective mobilization, all that kinds of things. So we do a conference, a big national conference, every other year. The next one is in Chicago next April 1-3. And we help organize local troublemaker schools. Just had one in Portland a couple months ago, and there's one in Seattle coming up next Saturday, where people build local solidarity, train in sort of practical mobilizing and organizing and steward skills, get re-energized.
So back to teachers.
And we also publish, we also publish a magazine once a month and articles online. I'm the editor of the magazine.
Yes, we should mention that. I've got a copy in front of me right now. That's how I'm getting my material here. So, we should mention also the specific teacher struggle going on in Seattle, since that's pretty close to us here in Portland. So can you give us an update as far as you're aware of what's going on there?
Yeah, it's quite exciting there. As far as I know, the last news I've read, they could still strike on Wednesday when school is slated to start. Bargaining is, of course, going on, long sessions, trying to reach a deal before then. They voted last week to authorize a strike. The Benaroya Hall, which is where the symphony performs in Seattle, was filled. It looked like, from the video, filled to capacity. You can see the video online. And that hall holds 2,000 or 3,000 people. So it would have been a good chunk of the union altogether had turned out there in their red shirts and And when they voted to strike, it was a unanimous vote. The hall sort of roared yes, and you could hear a pin drop when they asked for no's. So it seems like people are pretty pretty ready and determined there. And one of the biggest issues there has been adequate recess. They've been calling for ample recess for all students. They want 45 minutes. The last news I saw, in this hard bargaining in the last day, the district has finally agreed to at least a half an hour of recess. So you wouldn't think that that'd be such a hard thing to win, but it's inspiring to see teachers fighting so hard for that in Seattle.
And the other somewhat unique factor for Washington as a state is the issue of school funding and how that relates to the state constitution and state law and state court decisions, right?
Yes, it's quite remarkable. Washington's state constitution, it turns out, says that that education, that ample funding, not just adequate, but ample funding for the public schools is the paramount, is the absolute top priority of the state, and that's in the Constitution. And there's been a court case that's been sort of, you know, developing over a number of years. The state Supreme Court, which is the highest court in Washington, ruled that that the legislature is not living up to this constitutional responsibility, that they're illegally, unconstitutionally not funding the schools amply enough. And, the state, of course, had these excuses about, well, it's been hard times and we have other budgetary priorities. And the Supreme Court ruled, like, nope, the Constitution says it's the highest priority. This is not ample funding. You've got to fund the schools more. And has held the state in contempt of court for failing to take action to fix that problem. They were supposed to come up with a plan to get into compliance with the Constitution and haven't done so. And in the spring, this last spring, there were these amazing rolling strikes by teachers around the state. And it started up in the Bellingham area and really came up from the ranks of teachers, this idea of let's hold one-day strikes to call attention to this problem. Teachers there say that really the biggest effects of the underfunding are that class sizes are among the biggest in the country, that class sizes are way too big, and that teachers have gone without pay raises for a number of years, and as inflation's gone up, have taken a pay cut, their healthcare contribution. Teachers are more and more underpaid in the state of Washington, and so they've been raising those two issues, class size and teacher pay, together, and held these rolling one-day strikes that by the end of the spring, half the teachers in the state had taken part in these one-day strikes, not against their local districts, but against the state legislature to say we need more funding for our schools.
Let me mention you're listening to KBOO Portland. This is the Solidarity Special, this being Labor Day, and we're talking with Al Bradbury of Labor Notes in New York City. Al, as the movement faces changing times, we have, besides the what we might call traditional labor unions, we have some new structures. We have things like workers' centers and movements of fast food workers, sort of informally organized or new forms of organization to wage the struggle. How do you see that? What's happening? What's the evolution? How are the new and the old structures able to work together or not? And where are things headed?
Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? The employers over the last few decades have gotten more and more sophisticated in how they devise new ways of setting up employment relationships to try to give workers less power, less legal power to organize, and also less leverage in every way, from, you know, the increasing subcontracting and people working for temp agencies, even in traditional industries, by the way. You see in, for instance, auto plants, which you think of as an organized, I mean, even in the organized auto plants, there will be people who are working alongside the union auto workers who are working for a temp agency, a staffing agency, and are non-union. You have all this sort of web of subcontracting. And that's a kind of employment relationship that is, you know, I think there's a lot of attention to it in the last couple of years. It's not as new as the last couple of years. It's been over the last few decades creeping. But it is interesting to see this organizing, and then in things like fast food, where people have an employer, but their direct employer is a franchise holder who isn't really the one pulling the strings. McDonald's is the one pulling the strings, and how do you build the leverage to get at McDonald's? So it's exciting to see unions and other organizations both working on tackling how we organize people in all these different in all these different kinds of setups. And many of them, you know, and often in, there are both worker centers that are freestanding worker centers, and there are worker centers that are sort of parallel organizations supported by and working with unions. And there are people who are organizing even directly with traditional unions, even in non-traditional ways. To me, the most important thing in any of these efforts, though, is that worker control and democracy remain at the heart of them. I think the danger in sort of experimenting with new forms of organizing is experimenting with the kind that are like that are run by the staff of an organization, or where sort of that workers be figureheads in a PR campaign. And something that Labor Notes has always stood strongly for and continues to stand strongly for is that organizing in the workplace, whether it's under the banner of a worker center or a union or any kind of organization, be owned by the workers who are organizing. And so I think there are a number of you know, and that's something that some unions are better than others, some worker centers are better than others. There are some really exciting examples. The New York taxi workers, for instance, are a great example of a really worker-run organization. And closer to home, I think Casa Latina, the worker center, day labor worker center in Seattle, is a really directly worker-run organization.
Maybe as we're facing the very much needed and hopefully soon arriving transition away from a carbon economy, some of these new structures will be especially important. You've talked some in your writing about the idea of a just transition from the present to a new economy, and maybe this is a space where the new forms will be very useful. What do you think?
Yeah, I certainly hope so. It's it is. We live in a tricky moment where it's we're faced with this giant threat to our survival as a planet, and it's an uncomfortable truth that many of us go to work each day and contribute to the problem through our labor. Often, not the workers deciding to set up their labor that way, right? But the corporations or employers have it set up that way, and in some cases, you have jobs that workers have fought for decades to make good jobs with decent pay, with some control over the work, that now they're being told, well, this job is unsustainable in a green economy and we'll have to go. And I think there's some real, some well-grounded fears in, for instance, the longshore industry or the oil refining industry, that where workers have won standards, good working standards, but then their jobs will go away and the jobs that replace them will be low-wage jobs with no worker control. That's not a reason not to transition to a sustainable economy, certainly, because we may all perish from the planet. But I think this idea of a just transition is a really interesting one. And this is a term the late leader Tony Mazzocchi of the Oil, Chemical, and Atomic Workers used to talk about a just transition. That union later became part of the Steelworkers. And the idea was that, of course, you shouldn't pit workers against the planet when we change the way jobs are set up in order to build towards climate friendly jobs, or for any other reason. When work is restructured, you should do no harm to the workers who are displaced. And he would say practically that, for instance, you should have workers should have their full salary and tuition while they retrain for new jobs. And I think we can apply that to the oil refining jobs, if some of those are to be lost. I think it's likely that there'll be some jobs refining biofuels, but workers in the coal industry, should not be harmed. You could also apply this idea to mass incarceration. I think it's incontrovertible that there are too many prisons in this country, that there's a great injustice being done specifically to communities of color that are incarcerated at disproportionate rates, that we need morally to close a lot of prisons. Also, prisons provide a lot of union jobs, especially in rural communities that don't have enough decent jobs. So certainly a just transition would be a principle to urgently apply there to providing good jobs. And I think when we think about the transition to a single-payer health plan and all the workers in the insurance industry who will be displaced, the principle of a just transition is one that we could apply in thinking in all kinds of ways about a different kind of economy and a fair shift.
And, of course, it also matters who has a voice and how these transitions happen. The other quote you mentioned in your article was to the effect of you're either at the table or you're on the menu. So workers and communities need to have a voice in all these processes, or the rest of it doesn't do a whole lot of good for most of us, maybe for a few, but not for many. Al, I want to thank you very much for joining us this Labor Day. Hope you and everybody else back there makes the most of the opportunity to get together and build solidarity, and hope to see you again in Portland one of these days.
Thanks so much, and a happy Labor Day to you too, John.
Thanks, Al. Now we have joining us on the line the director, executive director of Portland Jobs with Justice, Diana Peiwu. Diana, welcome.
Morning, John.
How are you doing this Labor Day?
Doing good, trying to stay warm.
Yeah, it's a little bit, the seasons changed quickly here this year. I went away for a week, it was summer, came back, it was fall, but that happens, I guess. So, in your perspective now from your seat at Portland Jobs with Justice and your previous organizing work here locally, what are the things that are really big on your radar as far as the issues of the moment in Portland and Oregon and in the region for labor?
Yeah, thanks, John. there's a couple of different campaigns that Portland Jobs with Justice are bottom lining right now. First, I'm really excited because, you know, Portland Jobs with Justice is a coalition of over 100 faith institutions, unions, worker organizations, community organizations, and even some small businesses. And we've been in Portland. We turn 25 next year. And so we hope that everyone on the radio today will come and join us for our 25th anniversary in April or May of next year. There's a couple of big things on the radar. One of them is, I think most people on the radio today will have heard something about the Fight for 15. Started 2 years ago in New York with restaurant workers. That movement has really spread like wildfire all over the United States, and certainly here in Oregon, we have a very active Fight for 15. there's a local campaign called the Portland Area Campaign for 15, which Jobs with Justice is bottom lining. And we're working with unions to win 15 through their contract bargaining campaigns through, you know, worker and community solidarity. And we're asking for community organizations and faith institutions to voluntarily also commit to paying 15. Surprisingly, we've been, by talking to small community organizations and many faith-based institutions, they already have moved their people up to 15 in the last year because that demand was out there. They realized if we aren't paying our workers a minimum wage, it's not fair as social justice institutions, as faith-based institutions. So it's super exciting. Some of the key wins around the campaign for 15 right now are the struggles that are happening locally. I think many of you may have heard the SEIU 503, the home care workers, just won a massive win, 15 in a union for over 24,000 workers statewide. We know that PSU is ready to strike. The SEIU 49 is fighting for 15 in a union at the airport, which is a pretty big deal. And I think they're at the place where 15 in a union, they did win a bunch of safety standards improvements over the last year, thanks to, you know, community and faith support and, of course, the massive organizing by workers there. Our Unite Here, Local 8, not part of the campaign for 15, but is working very actively. They're going to be speaking at a Food Chain Workers Alliance meeting in the next with Joanne Lowe, who's sort of nationally recognized around food chain workers, on September 14th at 4:30. And then we also work with AFSCME, Laborers 483, and the Janus Youth Workers that are both AFSCME and IWW, International Workers of the World, through the campaign for 15. So it's a lot of unions and several community organizations as well.
How about the legislative aspect of this in terms of Oregon?
Yeah, in Oregon, it's also really exciting. You know, the national movement has gained so much momentum that there's both a statewide ballot measure that's looking to raise statewide wages to 15 by 2020, I think. So it would be 11 something in the first year, 13 something in the second year, and then getting to 15 over sort of the third or fourth years. It sort of parallels some of the raises, and it's tagged to cost of living adjustments. It parallels that in New York, you know, the raises in the minimum wage there will really be in effect by 2020. And so it's both super exciting that people are thinking about raising the wage and actively pursuing campaigns to make it to do that. And also, you know, it's very realistic for a lot of small businesses that they can plan. So it's a very predictable plan for raising the wage over time. And it's not increments that should be so threatening, especially to a lot of the small businesses. The other thing that's happening right now is that there is a legislative initiative through our Oregon and the Raise the Wage Coalition in Oregon. They're fighting to raise the wage, and they're fighting to repeal the local preemption, which is something that Jobs with Justice is also really excited about. You know, many, many years ago when we were so successful locally at passing living wage ordinances, the businesses were upset enough that they took it to the statewide level and passed a local preemption against being able to set your own, you know, local minimum wages. And so it had to be set at the statewide level. And so, honestly, we see both of those efforts as a win for workers in Oregon. Our campaign for 15 locally recognizes that here in Portland, 15, when I talk to my friends who are low-wage workers in the service industry, most of them are like, that's great. It's still, you know, you still got to have roommates. You still are skimping on your health care. You're still, like, cutting corners all over the place when you're on 15 if you get the hours that you need. But it's huge, and it would, you know, it makes everybody able to breathe just a little bit better.
Now, what you described is a mixture of various strategies. So we have unions in their contract fights. We have responsible employers. We have legislative initiatives. What's your view of the organizing strategy that works now in this moment? What's the approach? Are we talking about broad coalitions? Are we talking about, you know, pursuing multiple channels? What's the way to make this happen?
I think it's, you know, it's a lot of times when people talk about movement building, you really talk about multiple fronts. And so where there's already organized units of workers, having them fight for 15 at the bargaining table makes, you know, absolute sense, especially if they're in Portland, especially if they're in places. It also helps mobilize, you know, the members of unions. It also helps inspire union rank and file members. And so it's one of those things that you can build both internal loyalty, but also, you know, results in real material gains for people in our community. So that's part of the strategy. We think multiple fronts are really important. We know that faith and community organizations are also, you know, part of our community and workers, and also play a really important role in talking about sort of what is the norm, right? What is our new normal? And I think in February, we had a local sort of agreement, especially with the laborers, right? A lot of the city workers and part-time temporary workers and people that were being classified as casual, but really doing sort of permanent workers' jobs, have now, like, that situation has been rectified. And so several thousand workers have been able to move up to 15. So I think, like, showing that it's possible through union fights as well as all of these legislative measures is really important, having that sort of multiple strategies. Honestly, by winning these smaller fights locally, we're hoping to get to 30,000 workers in the Portland area by 2017. That's one out of every four workers in Portland who right now isn't making 15 yet. So it's sort of an exciting opportunity to change the bar on what people are making here in Portland, but also hopefully inspire movement at a larger and broader level. I'd also say that the folks at 15 now really have built strong bases in Eugene and Southern Oregon around 15 now. And so, you know, we're working together to figure out what's the right relationship to have with all of these campaigns so that we can, again, so that we can really win, you know, for people here working in Oregon.
And how about the interaction between labor and broader social movements? So we're talking about things like Black Lives Matter, about equality and equity for people regardless of gender identity. We're talking about a number of movements now that are very, very powerful. Occupy was an example a little while back. I mean, how does labor learn from, interact with, contribute to? What's the way to move forward on a broader front for everybody?
Yeah, you know, it's fun. When you think about these key strikes in the civil, or key moments in the civil rights movement, right? One of them is the Memphis sanitation workers strike. And as the sisters and brothers over at AFSCME remind me, that's one of the founding moments or sort of reactivation moments for their union. And so I would say, you know, my friend Tom Goldtooth at the Indigenous Environmental Network today reminded me, and Tom Tanner and the iron workers reminded me recently that iron workers have a long history of Native American workers, right, especially the Skywalkers who helped build the skyscrapers in New York, especially a lot of the Mohawk folks who helped build New York City. And so when you think about that, when you think about Chinese ladies garment workers being one of the first sort of people of color locals and the garment workers and the International Ladies Garment Workers Union in San Francisco in the 30s as being a key sort of organizing point that has influenced organizing in the Chinese American community ever since. We have a long history, really, of sort of people of color in the labor movement, right, and vice versa, that labor has been key in other kinds of social struggles. You know, from the key moments in WTO where people were excited to have sort of Teamsters and Turtles, right?
Mm-hmm.
I remember in Detroit at the U.S. Social Forum a few years back, 2010, there were Teamsters again marching with environmentalists and youth organizations in the street trying to close one of the dirtiest incinerators in the Midwest. And that worked, right? So few months later, that incinerator closed, and they've been working to sort of find good jobs and to build sort of better jobs, right? Sort of the just transition that Al was talking about earlier. And so that sort of Teamsters and Turtles, in that case, in 2010, it was Teamsters and Sunflowers. You know, that has continued to carry forward. And even that really large People's Climate March that people saw in New York earlier are places where sort of movements have been able to intersect and to be able to be with each other. I think one of the things that was really cool was a few months back, I believe it was in San Francisco, where people asked the question, you know, in the rise of the Black Lives Matter movement, what's the relationship of the Black Lives Matter movement to the labor movement, and brought out African-American trade unionists, to talk about what the options are, what it can mean for the labor movement, but also how labor can potentially also intersect, right, with Black Lives Matter and with sort of those kinds of movements.
I see we have a caller on the line, so let's take that call. Jamie, what do you have to say?
Hey, John, Diana, good morning. Happy Labor Day.
Likewise.
Just to take off on what Diana was talking about, the intersection of the Black Lives Matter movement and the labor movement, when you look at the Fight for 15, which started out, you know, 3 years ago in fast food worker strikes in New York City fighting for 15 in the union, and swept the country, just moved across the country to the place where we're last April, where in 250 cities, there were 60,000 low-wage workers on strike for 15 in the union. You look at the photos, the people of color, you know, low-wage workers are disproportionately people of color, and black people are twice as likely to be low-wage workers as white people. And in the beginnings of the Black Lives Matter movement, in the Ferguson rebellions, the folks from the Fight for 15 showed up. They're the same people. They're young black people, and they're in rebellion for better lives. And just know that that's the basis of the Fight for 15, that's what's moving this whole conversation nationally. And the reason, and I'm one of the chief petitioners for the ballot initiative for $15 minimum wage here in Oregon. And the reason that people know, you know, when we're out on the street, you know, talking to people with our petitions about 15 is because of this movement that has swept the country. It's caught the imagination of low-wage workers everywhere. And just to let folks know that we need your help. We're trying to get 88,000 signatures to get on the ballot for November 2016. And we're going to be out on the street with those petitions. And we'll have a big kickoff on the 26th of September. So go to 15nowpdx.org, 15nowpdx.org to get involved this week. ballot initiative for a $15 minimum wage in Oregon. Thank you.
Thanks, Jamie. And with Jamie and Diana, we have two out of three of the chief petitioners on the line right now. So we kind of got that one covered, I think. Diana, do you want to tell people how to plug in with Jobs with Justice if they want to get more involved and more active in the movement?
Absolutely. We've got a couple of different ways you can get plugged in and involved in the next short period. On September 19th is our annual Fall for Solidarity Party. It's another way that labor helps support, you know, community organizations, in this case, our local workers center, VOLS, Workers' Rights Education Project. And so they run the Day Labor Center, where they both provide training and a safe place for day laborers to wait and look for jobs. They also guarantee a $12 minimum wage for the day laborers, and they're exploring the ability to move to 15. So, you know, support VOLS, support the fight for 15. Come out and dance with us. There's a lesson at 6 at the SEIU 503 Hall on Foster and Holgate in Southeast, and the party start, doors open at 6. There's a lesson, there'll be food, and then a live band. So should be, or a DJ Patti will be there. And so it should be, you know, good people, good fun. On September 25th, you know, the Pope is having a blessing of workers in Philadelphia. And so we're having a session at the same time, September 25th, noon, probably somewhere in the PSU Park blocks, and we'll be doing a blessing, an interfaith blessing of workers at that point. We're really looking forward to having a strong turnout of both workers and community organizations around his new economic justice platform. And then our Climate Jobs PDX, which is one of the affiliates of Portland Jobs with Justice, wanted to remind me that Joe Unlin is going to be here in town on October 10th, 2015 at 6:30 p.m. at the AFL-CIO Hall. That's over on Southeast 32nd and just south of Powell Boulevard. And it should be an evening of music and dialogue with labor activists on climate and jobs. So, you know, again, John is the founding president and executive director of the Labor Network for Sustainability. So it's a real exciting opportunity to think and act more deeply at the intersection of those issues. And then to get more involved, you can check out our website, jwjpdx.org, sign up for our email newsletter. We basically tell you once a week what the next actions for labor and community are. To get on that calendar, you need to be an affiliate and join JWJ. We have, you know, and so everyone who's down for social and racial and gender justice, you know, you're absolutely invited as an organization to come be a member of our coalition.
And the basic operational principle of Jobs with Justice is that we come out for each other's struggles. If people show up for each other's struggles, we're all stronger together.
Yeah, and if you take the pledge, you know, we'll track what actions you come to. And hopefully for the 25th anniversary, we'll be celebrating everyone who met their pledge, which was 5 actions a year.
And that comes back to the theme of this show overall, that our struggles are interrelated. We have things to learn from each other and ways to support each other. Diana just mentioned VOS, and many of the workers who are here as day laborers were displaced from their countries of birth by free trade agreements. NAFTA pushed a lot of people out of Mexico who wound up in the U.S. just trying to make a living as profits crossed the border, but people were not allowed to. We've seen the effect of injuries on the job in Colombia, but also I see it in my workplace where people are denied operations they need to recover from injuries. We've talked about organizing at the level of the nation, at the level of the community. We've talked about it in terms of social movements, but also in terms of labor rights and specific needs to make a living, standards of living we all need to have. I hope this Labor Day you all have a good time. You're able to get out and enjoy and meet and greet and have fun with folks, but also you're able to build solidarity. You're able to reinforce the movement. You're able to find ways that we go forward together and go forward stronger. Thank you all for listening. Very glad to have you join us this Labor Day. Enjoy the day. For Steve the Engineer, myself, John Walsh, for Labor Radio Collective, and for KBOO, thank you, and talk to you later.
Have you entered the KBOO Fall Membership Drive Sweepstakes? The grand prize is a trip to Busurias, Mexico, including $1,000 in airfare and a week's worth of lodging at Casa Tranquila. Other prizes include a Portland Center Stage Flex Pass, hundreds of dollars to Grand Central Bakery, and health and wellness packages at Evolution Healthcare and Fitness. We have raised over $10,000 at this time to help shorten the fall membership drive. Remember, for every $15,000 we raise before September 9th, we will take one day off our fall membership drive. A donation is not required to enter the sweepstakes. For more info, visit kboo.fm/2015fallsweeps. And thank you to everyone who has donated early to the fall membership drive.
You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is coming up just on 9 o'clock, which means it's time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from EcoPlumber, providing sustainable plumbing services to Portland and the metro area, including remodels, repipes, and repair, as well as green projects such as rainwater or graywater harvesting, and alternative materials such as 100% VOC-free green pipe. Information at 503-342-8244 or eco-plumber.com. This program has also been made possible in part by True West, presenting American singer-songwriter and former Black Crow Jackie Green with Lauren Shira, Thursday, September 10th at the Wonder Ballroom. Tickets and information for Jackie Green on September 10th at the Wonder Ballroom are available at ticketfly.com.
Wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.